length of the motorcade over the truck's cab. All he could see was stationary armour and laden trucks right down to the bend in the road, 300 meters away. He keyed his microbead as he glanced back down at Fagor. "Get them up," Rawn told his adjutant. Fagor nodded and relayed the glib order to the 50 or so men in the transport cargo area. The ghosts, many of them sweating and without headgear, roused and readied their weapons, scanning the tree line and field ditches to the right of the road. "One, three," said Rawn into his link. There was a lot of vox traffic. Questioning calls were running up and down the convoy.
"Three, one,"
replied Gaunt from up ahead.
"One, what's the story?"
"One of the munition chimeras has thrown a track section. I'm going to wait 15 minutes and see how the techs do. Longer than that, I'll leave them behind."
Rawn had seen the battered age of the worn chimeras they'd been issued by the Munitorium motor pool. It would take more than fething 15 minutes to get one running, in his opinion.
"Permission to recreationally disperse my men along the river edge."
"Granted, but watch the tree line."
Setting two men on point to cover the right-hand side of the road, Rawn ordered the rest of his troops off the truck. Joking, pulling off jackets and boots, they jogged down to the river edge and started bathing their feet and throwing hand scoops of water on their faces. Other troop trucks pulled off the hardpan onto the levee shoulder and disembarked their men. A Trojan tank tractor grumbled past, edging up along the length of the stationary column from the rear echelon to assist with the spot repairs. Rawn wandered down the line of vehicles to where Sergeants Vahl, Sorek, Baffles, and Haller stood on the levee. Sorek was handing out stubby cigars from a waxed card box, and Rawn took one. They all smoked for a while in silence, watching the ghosts, both Vergastite and Tanith, engage in impromptu water fights and games of kickball.
"Is it always like this, Major?"
Sorek asked, jerking a thumb at the unmoving convoy. Rawn didn't warm to people much, but he liked the old man. He was a capable fighter and a good leader, but he wasn't afraid to ask questions that revealed his inexperience, which in Rawn's book made him a good student and a promising officer.
"Always the same with motorized transportation. Breakdowns, bottlenecks, bad terrain. I always prefer to shift the men by foot."
"The Bardas equipment looks all right," said Haller.
"Well maintained and all."
Rawn nodded.
"That's just the drunk transports the Munitorium found for us. These trucks are as old as Feth. And the chimeras."
"I'm surprised they've made it this far," said Vahl.
The sergeant gently windmilled his arm, nursing the cybernetic shoulder joint the augmeticists had given him on Fortis Binary several years before. It still hurt him in humid conditions.
"And we'd be Feth without them. Without the munitions they're carrying, anyway."
"We're Feth anyway," said Rawn.
"We're the Imperial Fething Guard, and it's our lot in life to be Feth."
Haller, Sorek, and Vahl laughed darkly. But Baffles was silent. A stocky bearded man with a blue claw tattoo under one eye, Baffles had been promoted to sergeant after Old Foles was killed at the Battle for Verver Gate. He still wasn't comfortable with command, and took his duties too seriously, in Rawn's opinion. Some common troopers, Vahl was a good example, were sergeants waiting to happen. Baffles was an honest footslogger who'd had responsibility dumped on him because of his age, his dependability, and his good favor with the men. Rawn knew he was finding it hard. Gaunt had had a choice when it came to Foles's replacement, Baffles or Milo, and he'd opted for Baffles because to give the lead job to the youngest and greenest ghost would have smacked of favoritism. Gaunt had been wrong there, Rawn thought. He had no love for Milo, but he knew how capable he'd proved to be and how dearly the men regarded him as a lucky totem. Gaunt should have gone with his gut, ability over experience.
"Good smoke,"
Vahl told Sorek, glancing appreciatively at the smouldering brown tube between his fingers.
"Korbeck would have enjoyed them."
"Finest Vergast leaf,"
smiled Sorek.
"I have a private stock."
"He should be here,"
Baffles said, meaning the colonel. Then he glanced quickly at Rawn.
"No offense, Major."
"None taken,"
Rawn replied. Privately, Rawn was enjoying his newfound seniority. With both Korbeck and that upstart Captain Dower out of the picture, he was now the acting second of the regiment, with only the Pardus Major Cleopas and the outsider Commissar Hark near to him in the task force pecking order. McColl was the ghost's number three officer for the duration, and Collier had been given Dower's Vergastite liaison tasks. It still irked Rawn that he was forced to maintain the callsign Three to Gaunt's One. Gaunt had explained it was to preserve continuity of Vox recognition, but Rawn felt he should be using Corbex too, now. What irked him more was the notion that Baffles was right. Corbeck should be here. It went against Rawn's impulse because he'd never liked Corbeck that much either, but it was true. He felt it in his blood. What everyone knew, and none wanted to talk about, was that this seemed likely to be the last mission of the Tanith First. The Lord General had broken Gaunt, and Rawn would lead the applause when they came to march Gaunt away in disgrace. But still, this was the Ghost's final show, and Fethim, Corbeck should be here. Mad Larkin sat, hot and edgy, in the rear of a vacated truck, his long pattern las resting on the bodywork. Collier had left him and Koo on point, while the others ran to the river to cool down and blow off steam. Larkin searched the far side of the road with his usual obsessive methods, sectioning the tree line and the expanse of waterfield by eye, and then scanning each section in turn, sequentially. Thorough, careful, faultless. Each movement made him tense, but each movement turned out to be flapping forkbills or scampering spider rats or even just the breeze sway of the fronded leaves. He passed the time with target practice, searching out a target and then following it through his scope's crosshairs. The red-crested forkbills were fine enough, but they were an easy target because of their white plumage and size. The spider rats were better, creepy, ape-limbed mammals the size of Larkin's hand that jinked up and down the tree trunks in skittering stop-start trajectories so fast they made a sport out of it.
"What are you up to?"
Larkin looked round and up into Trooper Koo's arrogant eyes.
"Just sporting," Larkin said.
He didn't like Koo at all. Koo made him nervous. People called Larkin mad, but he wasn't mad like Koo. Koo was a cold killer, a psycho. He was covered in gang tats and had a long scar that bisected his narrow face. Koo folded his lean limbs down next to Larkin. Larkin thought of himself as thin and small amongst the ghosts, but Koo was smaller. There was, however, a suggestion of the most formidable energy in his wiry frame.
"You could hit them?"
he asked.
"What?" "The white birds with the stupid beaks." "Yeah, easy. I was hunting the rats." "What rats?"
Larkin pointed.
"Those things. Creepy fetin bugs." "Oh, yeah. Didn't see them before. Sharp eyes you got. Sharp as sharp."
"Goes with the territory," Larkin said, patting his sniper weapon.
"Sure it does. Sure as sure."
Koo reached into his pocket and produced a couple of hand-rolled white smokes, which he offered in a V to Larkin.
"No thanks."
Koo put one away and lit the other, drawing deep. Larkin could smell the scent of Obscura. He'd used it occasionally back on Tanith, but it was one of Gaunt's banned substances. Feff, but it smelled strong.
"Colonel Commissar will have you for that stuff," he said.
Koo grinned and exhaled ostentatiously.
"Gaunt doesn't frighten me," he said. "You sure you want?"
"No thanks."
"Those gacking white birds,"
Koo said after a long interval.
"You reckon you could hit them easily?"
"Yeah.
I'm betting they could be good in the pot. Bulk up standard rations, a few of them."
It was a decent enough idea. Larkin keyed his link. "Three, this is Larks. Q and I are going off the track to nab a few water birds for eating. Okay with you?"
"Good idea. I'll advise the convoy you're going to be shooting. Bag one for me."
Larkin and Q dropped off the side of the truck and wandered across the road. They slithered down the field embankment into an irrigation ditch where the watery mud sloshed up around their calves. Forkbills warbled and clacked in the cycad grove ahead. Larkin could already see the telltale dots of white amongst the dark green foliage. Skeeterflies buzzed around them, and sap wasps droned over their heads. Larkin slid his sound suppressor out of his uniform's thigh pouch and carefully screwed it onto the muzzle of his long las. They came up around a clump of fallen palms, and Larkin nestled down in the exposed root system to take aim. He scope-chased a spider rat up and down a tree bole for a moment to get his eye in, and then settled on a plump forkbill. The trick wasn't to hit it. The trick was to knock its head off. A las round would explode a forkbill into feathers and mush if it hit the body, like taking a man out by jamming a tube charge down his waistband. Shoot the inedible head off, and you'd have a ready-to-pluck carcass. Larkin squared up, shook his head and shoulders out, and fired. There was a slight flash and virtually no noise. The forkbill, now with nothing but a scorched ring of flesh and feathers where its head should have joined on, dropped off into the shallow water. In short order, Larkin pinked off 5 more. He and Koo sloshed out to gather them up, hooking them by the webbed feet into their belts.
"You're getting good," Koo said.
"Thanks."
"That's a hell of a gun."
"Sniper variant Longlars, my very best friend."
Koo nodded.
"I believe that. You mind if I take a try?"
Koo held his hand out, and Larkin reluctantly handed the long las to him, taking Koo's standard las rifle in return. Koo grinned at the new toy and eased the Gnarlwood stock against his shoulder.
"Nice," he sighed. "Nice as nice."
He fired suddenly, and a forkbill exploded in a mass of white feathers and blood.
"Not bad, but—"
Koo ignored Larkin and fired again. And again, and again. 3 more forkbills detonated off their perches.
"We can't cook them if you hit them square," Larkin said.
"I know. We've got enough for eating now. This is just fun."
Larkin wanted to complain, but Koo swung the long las round quick fire and destroyed 2 more birds. The water under the trees was thick with bloodstains and floating white feathers.
"That's enough," said Larkin. Koo shook his head and aimed again. He'd switched the long las to rapid fire, and when he pulled the trigger, pulse after pulse whined into the canopy. Larkin was alarmed. Alarmed at the misuse of his beloved weapon, alarmed at Koo's psychopathic glee, and most of all, alarmed at the way Koo's wildfire blasted and crisped a 6 spider rats off the surrounding tree trunks. Not a shot was wasted or went wide. Skittering targets even he'd have to think twice about hitting were reduced to seared, blood-leaking impacts on the trees. Koo handed the weapon back to Larkin.
"Nice gun," said Koo,
and turned back to rejoin the road. Larkin hurried after him. He shivered, despite the sun's heat, that baked down over the highway. Cold killer. Larkin knew he'd be watching his back from now on. At the front end of the immobile convoy, Gaunt, Cleopas, and Herodas stood watching the tech priests and engineers of the Pardus regiment as they struggled to retrack the defective Chimera. A work team of Pardus and Tanith personnel had already unloaded the armored transport by hand to reduce its payload weight. The Trojan throbbed and idled nearby like a watchful parent. Gaunt glanced at his chronometer.
"Another 10 minutes and we'll move on regardless."
"I might object, sir,"
Cleopas ventured.
"This unit was carrying shells for the Conquerors."
He gestured to the massive stack of munitions the work team had removed from the Chimera to get it upright.
"We can't just leave this stuff."
"We can if we have to," said Gaunt.
"If this was a payload of lasgun power cells, you'd say different."
"You're right," Gaunt nodded to Cleopas. "But we're on the tightest of clocks, Major. I'll give them 20 minutes, but only 20.
Captain Herodas moved away to shout encouraging orders at the engineer teams. Gaunt pulled out a silver hip flask. It was engraved with the name Delane Oktar. He offered it to Cleopas.
"Thank you, Colonel Commissar. No, a little early in the day for me."
Gaunt shrugged and took a swig. He was screwing up the cap when a voice from behind them said,
"I hear shooting."
Gaunt and Cleopas looked around at Commissar Hark as he approached them.
"Just a little authorized foraging," Gaunt told him. "Do the squad leaders know? It might trigger a panic."
"They know. I told them. Regulation 110119 Gamma.
Hark made an open-handed shrug.
"You don't need to cite it to me, Colonel. I believe you."
"Good. Major Cleopas, perhaps you'd explain to the Commissar here what is happening. In intricate detail."
Cleopas glared at Gaunt and then turned to smile at Hark.
"We're retracking the Chimera, sir, and that involves a heavy lifter, as you can see."
Gaunt slipped away, removing himself from the Commissar's presence. He walked back down the line of vehicles, taking another swig from the flask. Hark watched him go.
"What are your thoughts on the legendary Colonel Commissar?"
he asked Cleopas, interrupting a lecture on mechanized track repair.
"He's as sound a commander as I ever knew. Lives for his men.
Don't ask me again, sir. I won't have my words added to any official report of censure."
"Don't worry, Cleopas," said Hark. "Gaunt's damned any way you look at it. Lord General Lugo has him in his sights. I was just making conversation."
Gaunt walked back 100 meters and found Medic Kurth and her orderlies sitting in the shade cast by their transport. Kurth got up.
"Sir?"
"Everything fine here?" Gaunt asked.
He was unhappy with the fact that Dorden had stayed behind in the Doctrinopolis to see to the wounded. Kurth was a fine medic, but he wasn't used to her being in charge of the task force's surgical team. Dorden had always been his chief medic since the foundation of the Ghosts. Kurth would take a little getting used to.
"Everything's fine," she said, her smile as appealing as her heart-shaped face.
"Good," said Gaunt. "Good." He took another swig.
"Any of that going spare?" Kurth asked.
Surprised, he turned and handed her the flask. She took a hefty slug.
"I didn't think you'd approve."
"This waiting makes me nervous," she said,
wiping her mouth and handing the hip flask back to Gaunt.
"Me too,"
Gaunt said.
"Anyway," said Kurth, "trust me. It's medicinal."
Alpha AR pulled into Mukret in the late afternoon. The salamander rolled down to a crawl, and McColl, McVenna, and Bonin leapt out, las guns raised, trailing the light tank down the main highway as it passed through the jumble of stilt houses and raised halls. A slight breeze had picked up with the approach of evening, and it lifted dust and leaf litter across the bright sunlit road and the dark spaces of shadow between and under the dwellings. The sun itself, big and yellowing, shone sideways through a stiff break of palms and cypresses towards the river. The township was deserted. Doors flapped open, and epiphytic creepers roiled around window frames and stack posts. There was broken crockery on the housewalks, and litters of ragged clothing in the gutters. At the far end of the town sat long brick and tile smokehouses. Mukret's main industry was the smoke drying of fish and meats. The Tanith could still pick out the tangy background scent of wood smoke in the air. Behind the rolling tank, the three scouts prowled forward, lasguns held in loose, fluid grips. Bonin swung and aimed abruptly as forkbills mobbed out of a tree. The salamander rumbled. McColl moved ahead and switched Bonin left down a jetty walk to the river itself with a coded gesture. Ahead, something stirred. It was a Chelon, an immature calf, wandering out into the main road, dragging its reins in the dust. A short-form clutch saddle was lashed to its back. It wandered past McColl and McVenna, trailing its bridle. McColl could hear sporadic knocking now. McColl signaled for McVenna to hold back as cover and walked forward towards the noise. An old man, skinny and gnarled, was hammering panels into place on an old and ransacked stilt chapel. It looked like he was trying to board up broken windows using only a length of tree limb as a hammer. He was dressed in blue silk robes. Ayatani, McColl realized. The local priesthood.
Father!
The old man turned and lowered his tree limb. He was bald, but had a triumphantly long, tapering white beard. It was so long, in fact, that he tucked it over his shoulder to keep it out of the way.
"Not now,"
he said in a crotchety tone.
"I'm busy. This holy shrine won't just repair itself."
"Maybe I can help you." The old man clambered back down to the roadway and faced McColl.
"I don't know. You're a man with a gun, and a tank, it appears. You may be intending to kill me and steal my Chelon, which, personally speaking, I would not find helpful. Are you a murderer?"
"I'm a member of the Imperial Liberation Force," McColl replied, looking the old man up and down.
"Really? Well, now,"
the old man mused, using the tip of his long beard to mop his face. "What's your name?"
"Ayatani Zwile,"
said the old man.
"And yours?"
"Scout Sergeant McColl."
"Scout Sergeant McColl, eh? Very impressive. Well, Scout Sergeant McColl, the Urshul have fouled this shrine, this sacred house of our thrice-beloved saint, and I intend to rebuild it stick by stick. If you assist me, I will be grateful, and I'm sure the saint will be too, in her way."
"Father, we're heading west. I need to know if you've seen any Infardi on the road."
"Of course I have. Hundreds of them."
McColl reached for his vox link, but the old man stopped him.
"Infardi I've seen plenty of. Pilgrims, flocking back to the Doctrinopolis. Yes, yes, plenty of Infardi, but no Urshul."
"I'm confused."
The Ayatani gestured up and down the sunlit road through Mukret.
"Do you know what you're standing on?"
"The Temberong Road," said McColl.
"Also known in the old texts of Iremrita as the Ayolta Amad Infardiri, which literally means the approved route of Infardi procession, or, more colloquially, the pilgrim's way. The road may go to Temberong, that way, eventually. Who wants to go there? A dull little city where the women have fat legs. But that way...
He pointed the direction McColl had appeared from.
In that direction, pilgrims travel. To the shrines of the Doctrinopolis Citadel. To the Templum Infafarid Sabbat. To 100 places of devotion. They have done for many hundreds of years. It is a pilgrim's way, and our name for pilgrims is Infardi. That is its proper sense, and I use it as such.
McColl coughed politely. So when you say Infardi, you mean real pilgrims?
Yes.
Coming this way?
Positively flocking. Scout Sergeant McColl, the Doctrinopolis is open again, so they come to give thanks. And they come to prostrate themselves before the desecrated citadel.
You're not referring to soldiers of the enemy, then?
They stole the name Infardi. I won't let them have it.
I won't.
If they want a name, let them be Ershul.
Ershul?
It is a word from the Ilath, the herdsman dialect. It refers to a Chelon that consumes its own dung, or the dung of others.
And have you seen, Ershul on your travels?
No. I see. But I've heard them.
Zweil suddenly took McColl by the arm and pointed him west, over the roofscape of Mukret, towards the distant edges of the rainwoods, which were becoming hazed and misty in the late afternoon. A dark stain of storm clouds was gathering over the neighbouring hills.
Up there, Scout Sergeant McColl. Beyond Bavnaga, in the sacred hills. They lurk. They prowl. They wait.
McColl involuntarily wanted to pull away from the old man's tight grip, but it was strangely reassuring. It reminded him of the way Archdeacon McKeer used to steer him to the lectern to read the lesson at church school back on Tanith years ago.
Are you a devout man, Scout Sergeant McColl?
I hope I am, Father. I believe the Emperor is God in flesh, and I live to serve him in peace and war.
That's good. That's good. Contact your fellows. Tell them to expect trouble on their pilgrimage.
20 kilometers east, the main convoy was moving again. The munitions chimera had been repaired well enough for the time being, though Intendant Elthan had warned Gaunt it would need a proper overhaul during the night rest. They were making good time again. Gaunt sat in the open cab of his command salamander, reviewing the charts and hoping they'd make it to Mukret before nightfall. McColl had just checked in. Alpha AR had reached Mukret and found it deserted, though the Dur scout had repeated his warning about Infardi sightings. Gaunt put the maps aside and turned to his battered, annotated copy of St. Sabbat's Gospel, as he had done many times that day. Trying to read the text in the jolting salamander made his head hurt, but he persisted. He flicked through to the most recent of the paper place markers he'd left. The midsection, the Psalms of Sabbat. Virtually impenetrable, their language both antique and mysteriously coded with symbols. He could read everything and nothing into them as meaning, but nothing was all he took away. Except that it was the most beautiful religious verse he'd ever read. Warmaster Slado had thought so too. It was from him that Gaunt had got his love of the Sabbat Psalms. His hands lowered the book to his knees as he looked up and remembered Slado for a moment. He felt a lurch as the tank slowed suddenly and stood up to look. His mount was third from the front of the convoy, and the two scout salamanders ahead had dropped speed sharply. Red brake lights came on behind their metal grills, stark and bright in the twilight. A large herd of massive Chelons was coming towards them, driven by several beige-robed peasants. It was half-blocking the road. The convoy leaders were being forced to pull into tight single file against the riverwood's edge of the highway. McColl had warned him about this. Lots of livestock and 3 harmless herdsmen, he'd said, though he'd seemed certain they'd be off the road before the convoy met them. "One to convoy elements," Gaunt said into his vox on the all-channel band. "Drop your speed and pull over to the extreme left. We've got livestock on the road. Show courtesy and pass well clear of them." The drivers and crews snapped back responses over the link. The convoy slowed to a crawl and began to creep along past the straggled line of lowing, shambling beasts. Gaunt cursed this fresh delay. It would be a good 10 minutes until they were clear of the obstruction. He looked out at the big shellbacks as they went by, close enough to lean out and touch. Their animal odor was strong and earthy, and Gorn could hear the creak of their leathery armor skin and the gurgle of their multi-chambered stomachs. They broke noxious wind, or groaned and snuffled. Blunt muzzles chewed regurgitated cuds. He saw the drovers, too. Large laborers in the coarse off-white robes of the agrarian caste, urging the beasts on with taps of their jiddy sticks, their hoods and face veils pulled up against the dust. A few nodded apologetically to him as they passed. Most didn't spare the Imperials a look. Religious war and sacred desecration ravages their world, and for them, it's business as usual, thought Gaunt. Some lives in this lethal galaxy were enviably simple. Lots of livestock and 3 harmless herdsmen. He remembered McColl's report with abrupt clarity. 3 harmless herdsmen. Now he was level with them, he counted at least 9. One. This is one. Be advised, this could be— His words were cut off by the bang shriek of a shoulder-launched missile. 2 vehicles back, a command salamander slewed wildly and vomited a fierce cone of flame and debris out of its crew space. Metal fragments rained down out of the air, tinking off his own vehicle's bodywork. The Voxlink went mad. Gaunt could hear sustained bursts of lasfire and auto-weapons. Herdsmen, suddenly several dozen in number, were surging out from the cover of their agitated animals. They had weapons. As their robes fell away, he saw body art and green silk. He grabbed his bolt pistol. The Infadi were all over them. Chapter 7. Death on the Road. Let me rest, now the battle's done. Imperial Guard song. His drover's disguise flapping about him, an Infadi gunman clambered up the mudguard of the command salamander and raised his auto-pistol, a yowl of rabid triumph issuing from his scabby lips. He stank of fermented fruit liquor, and his eyes were wild white with intoxicated frenzy. Gaunt's bolt round hit him point-blank in the right cheek and disintegrated his head in a puff of liquidized tissue. "One to honor guard units! Infadi ambush to the right! Turn and repel!" Gaunt could hear further missile impacts and lots of small arms fire. The Chelons, viced in by the road edge on one side and the Imperial armor on the other, were whinnying with agitation and banging the edges of their shells up against vehicle hulls. "Turn us! Turn us around!" Gaunt yelled at his driver. "No room, sir," the Pardus replied desperately. A brace of hard slug shots sparked and danced off the salamander's cowling. "Damn it!" Gaunt bellowed. He rose in the back of the tank and fired into the charging enemy, killing one Infadi and crippling a mature Chelon. The beast shrieked and slumped over, crushing 2 more of the ambushers before rolling hard into the chimera behind. It began to writhe, baying, shoving the tank into the verge. Gaunt swore and grabbed the firing grips of the pintle-mounted storm bolter. Infadi were appearing in the road ahead, and he raked the hard pan, dropping several. Some had swarmed over the leading scout tank ahead and were murdering the crew. The vehicle slewed to a drunken, sidelong halt. A tank round roared off close behind him. He heard the hot detonation of superheating gas, the grinding clank of the recoiling weapon, the whoosh of the shell. It fell in a ditch field to the right of the road and kicked up a huge spout of liquid muck. More tanks now fired their main guns, and turret-mounted bolters chattered and sprayed. Another big Chelon hit dead center by a tank shell, exploded wholesale, and a big stinking cloud of blood mist and intestinal gas billowed down the convoy. Gaunt knew they had the upper hand in terms of strength, but the ambushers had been canny. They'd slowed the convoy down with the livestock and pinned it against the road wall so it couldn't maneuver. He fired the weapon mount again, chopping through an Infadi running up to position a missile launcher. Dead fingers convulsed anyway, and the missile fired and immediately dropped, blowing a deep crater in the road. Something grabbed Gaunt from behind and pulled him off the storm bolter. He fell back into the tank's crew bay, kicking and fighting for his life. The first third of the honor guard convoy was under hard assault, jammed and slowed to such an extent by the herd that the trailing portion of the convoy, straggled back to a more than 4-kilometer spread now, couldn't move up to successfully support. Larkin found himself next to Koo, firing down from their troop truck body into the weeds as Infadi swarmed up out of the waterline, shooting as they came. Koo was giggling gleefully as he killed. An anti-tank rocket wailed over their heads, and lasfire exploded around them, killing a trooper nearby and blowing out the windows of the truck cab. "Disperse! Engage!" Sergeant Collier yelled, and the Tanith leapt from the trucks en masse, charging the attackers with fixed bayonets and blazing lasfire. Creed and Kafran charged together, hitting the first of the Infadi hand to hand, clubbing and gutting them. Kafran dropped for a wide shot that sent another ambusher tumbling back down the ditch into the field. Creed fell, got up, and laced las blasts into the shins of the Infadi stampeding towards them. A Pardis tank roared nearby, blindly shelling the herd. Rawn's truck, further down the line, was mobbed by Infadi. The cargo bed rocked as bodies piled onto it. Rawn fired his lasgun into the thick press and saw Fagor rip an enemy's throat out with his silver Tanith knife. The darkening evening air was crisscrossed by painfully bright lasfire. A second later, gusting flames surged down the roadside gully. From Val's truck, Trooper Brostin was washing the road line with bursts from his flamer. Major Clearpass tried to turn his conqueror, but a massive Chelon, bucking and hooting, slammed into his bull bars and shunted the entire tank around. For a full 5 seconds, the tank's racing tracks dragged at thin air as the weight of the bull Chelon drove its nose into the road. Then the tracks grabbed purchase again. Cleopas's tank lurched forward.
"Ram it!"
Cleopas ordered.
"Sir?"
"Screw you! Full power! Ram it!"
Cleopas barked down at his driver. The Conqueror battle tank, named Heart of Destruction according to the hand-painted hull logo, scrambled sideways in a vast spray of dust and then drove its bulldozer blade into the legs of the big bull Chelon. Cleopas's tank maimed the animal and rammed it off the highway, though the Conqueror dented its hull plating against the Chelon's shell in the process. Squealing, the Chelon fell down into the waterfield ditch and rolled over on its back, squashing 8 Infadi troopers in the irrigation gully. The Heart of Destruction dipped off the roadside and down into the waterbed, tracks churning. As his main gunner and gun layer pumped shells into the breaks of trees beyond the road, Cleopas manned the bolter hardpoint and blasted tracer shots across the irrigation ditches. His maneuver began to break the deadlock. 3 tanks followed him through the gap he'd cut and rattled round into the tree line off the road, wasting the dug-in Infadi with turret bolters and flamers. In the closed truck carrying the medical supplies, Anna Kurth flinched as stray shots punched through the hard skin and her racks of bottled pharmaceuticals. Glass debris spat in all directions. Lesp stumbled to his knees, a dark line of blood welling across his cheek from a sliver of flying glass. 2 Infadi clambered up the rear gate of the truck. Kurth kicked one away with a boot in the face, and then dragged out a las pistol Sorek had given her and fired twice. The second Infadi attacker fell off the truck. Kurth turned to see if Lesp was all right. She saw the alarm in his face, half heard the warning shout coming from his mouth, and then felt herself grabbed and pulled bodily out of the truck. Her world spun. Terror viced her. She was jerked upside down, held carelessly by the legs, her face in the dirt. The Infadi were all over her, clawing and tearing. She could smell their wretched sweat stink. All she could see was a jumble of green silk and tattooed flesh. There was a sudden glare of hard blue light and a sizzling sound. Hot liquid sprayed over her, and she realized, with professional detachment, that it was blood. She swung as the grip on her half released. The blur of blue light caved. The blur of blue light carved the air again, and something yelped. She collapsed onto the road, flat on her belly, and rolled up in time to see Ibram Gaunt raking his glowing power sword around in an expert figure-6 swing that felled an Infadi like a tree. Gaunt had lost his cap and his clothes were torn.
There was an unnerving look of unquenchable fury in his eyes. He wielded the sacred blade of her home hive two-handed now, like a champion of antique myth.
Dismembered bodies piled around him, and the gritty sand of the road was soaked with gore for meters in every direction. A hero, she thought abruptly, realizing it truly in her mind for the first time. Damn Lugo and his disdain. This man is an imperial hero. Lesp, his face running with blood, appeared suddenly behind the commissar in the back gate hatch of the medical truck and began laying down support fire with his lasgun. Gaunt staked his power sword tipped down in the road and knelt next to it, scooping up a fallen Infadi las rifle. His short, clipped bursts of fire joined Lesp's, stinging across the road and into the mob of Infadi. Green-clad bodies tumbled onto the road or slithered back down the trench into the field. Kurth scrambled over to Gaunt on her hands and knees. Once she was safely beside him, she too knelt and began firing with a purloined Infadi weapon. She had none of the Commissar's trained skill with an assault las, nor as much as Trooper Lesp, but she made a good account of herself with the unfamiliar weapon, nevertheless. Gaunt, grim and driven, handled his firing pattern with an assured expertise that would have shamed even a well-drilled infantryman.
"You didn't scream," Gaunt said to her suddenly, firing steadily.
"What? You didn't scream when they grabbed you?"
"And that's good. Why?"
"Waste of energy, of dignity. If they'd killed you, they'd have taken no satisfaction in it."
"Oh,"
she said, nonplussed, not sure if she should be flattered.
"Never give the enemy anything, Anna. They take what they take, and that's more than enough as it is."
"Live by that, do you?"
she asked, sourly, twitching off another burst of unsteady but enthusiastic shots.
"Yes,"
he replied, as if he was surprised she should ask. Sensing that, she felt surprised, too, at herself, for her own stupidity. It was obvious, and she'd known it all along if she'd but recognized it. That was Gaunt's way. Gaunt the Imperial hero. Give nothing. Never. Ever. Never let your guard down. Never allow the enemy the slightest edge. Stay firm and die hard. Nothing else would do. It wasn't just the Commissar in him. It was the warrior, Kurth realized. It was Gaunt's fundamental philosophy. It had brought him here and would carry him on to whatever death, kind or cruel, the fates had in store for him. It made him what he was, the relentless soldier, the celebrated leader, the terrifying slayer. She felt unbearably sad for him, and in awe of him all in the same moment. Anna Kurth had heard about the disgrace awaiting Gaunt at the end of this mission. That made her saddest of all. She realized he was going to be absolutely true to his duty and his calling right to the end, no matter the shadow of dishonor hanging over him. He would not falter. Gaunt would be Gaunt until death claimed him. 50 meters away, Captain Herodas fell out of a burning salamander a few moments before a second anti-tank rocket whooshed out of the roadside trees and blew it apart. Almost immediately, a hard slug tore through his left knee and threw him into the dust. He blacked out in pain for a second, and then fought back, trying to crawl. The Pardis trooper next to him was face down in a pool of blood.
"Lezink! Lezink!"
Herodas tried to turn the man over, but the limbs were loose and the body was hollow and empty. Herodas looked down and saw the horror of blown-out meat and bone shards that were all that remained of his own leg joint. Las shots zinged over his head. He reached for his pistol, but his holster was flapping open. There were tears in his eyes. The dull pain was rising to overwhelm him. From all around came the sounds of screaming, shooting, killing. The ground shook. Herodas looked up in disbelief at the cow Chelon that was stampeding towards him from the trapped, terrified herd. It was a third the size of the big bulls, but still weighed in at over 2 tons. He closed his eyes tight and braced for the bone-splintering impact that was about to come. A thin beam of hot red energy stabbed across the road and hit the hurtling brute with such force it was blown sideways off its feet. The shot disintegrated a huge hole in the Chelon and left it a smoldering husk, dripping fatty mush. Plasma fire, thought Herodas. Thrice damned gods, that was plasma fire! He saw the stocky shape of Commissar Hark striding down the roadway, dark in the rising dust and evening light, his long coat rippling around him. Hark was calling out commands and pointing as he directed the units of sprinting Tanith infantry down the road and into the enemy flank. He held an ancient plasma pistol in his right hand. Hark halted and sent 3 more troop units on past him as they ran up, forking them wide to disperse them into the roadside gutter. He turned and waved 2 Pardis conquerors forward, off the road, with quick, confident gestures. Then he spun round abruptly, brought up his weapon, and cremated an Infardi who had risen from the roadside weeds with a rifle. Hark crossed to Herodas.
"Stay still. Help's on the way." "Get me up and I'll fight,"
Herodas complained. Hark smiled.
"Your courage does you credit, Captain, but believe me, you're not going anywhere but to a medic cot. Your leg's a mess. Stay still."
He turned and fired his plasma gun into the trees again, at a target Herodas couldn't even see.
"They're all over us," Herodas said.
"No, they're breaking. We've got them running,"
Hark told him, holstering his plasma gun and kneeling down to apply a tourniquet to Herodas's thigh.
"The fight's out of them,"
he reassured the captain, but Herodas had blacked out again. The fight was indeed out of them. Overmatched and repulsed, leaving 2/3 of their number dead, The Infadi ambushers fled away into the off-road woodland, hunted by the Pardus shelling and the staccato thrash of the Hydra batteries. The front section of the convoy was a mess. Two scout salamanders and a command salamander ruined and burning. A supply chimera overturned and blown out. Two trucks ablaze. 22 Pardus dead. 15 ghosts. 6 Munitorium crewmen. 6 ghosts and 3 Pardus severely injured, and over 80 light wounds sustained by various personnel. Listening to the roll call of deaths and injuries on his microbead, Gaunt strode back to his vehicle, retrieving his cap and exchanging his torn storm coat for a short leather bomber jacket. He sat on the rear fender of his salamander as sweating troopers carried out the bodies of his driver and navigator. Smoke and blood fumes lingered over the scene. Infadi bodies were strewn everywhere, as well as the stricken Chelon. Some dead, some mortally hurt. The rest of the herd had broken into the waterfield and were disappearing as they moved away in the diminishing light. Gaunt could hear the snap of lasfire and the grumble of tanks as they cleared the low-lying woods. During the course of the fight, the sun had gone down, and the sky was now a smooth, luminous violet. Night breezes came up from the river and shivered the trees. They were badly behind schedule, a long way short of the planned night stop. It would be well after full dark before they reached Mukret now. Gaunt heard someone approach and looked up. It was Intendant Elthan, wearing the stiff grey robes of the Munitorium, and a look of disdain.
"This is unacceptable, Colonel Commissar," he said briefly.
"What is?"
"The losses. The attack."
"I'm afraid I don't follow you, Intendant. War isn't unacceptable. It's dirty and tragic and terrifying and often senseless. But it's also a fact of life."
"This attack," Elthan hissed, his lips tight around his yellowed teeth. "You were warned. Your scout detail warned you of the enemy presence. I heard it myself on the Voxlink. This should never have happened."
"What are you suggesting, Intendant? That I'm somehow culpable for these deaths?"
"That is exactly what I'm suggesting. You ignored your recon advice. You pressed on."
"That's enough," said Gaunt, getting to his feet. "I'm prepared to put your comments down to shock and inexperience. We should just forget this exchange happened."
"I will not," Elthan replied. "We all know the mess you made of the Doctrinopolis liberation. That shoddy leadership has cost you your career. And now you..."
"Menazoid Epsilon. Fortis Binary. Vervenhive. Monthax. Sapientia. Nasadon."
They both looked around. Hark stood watching them.
"Other examples of shoddy leadership, in your opinion, Intendant?"
Elthan went a little red around the edges and then blustered on.
I expect your support on this, Commissar. Are you not here for the express purpose of disciplining and supervising this broken man?"
"I'm here to discharge the duties of an Imperial Commissar," said Hark simply.
"You heard the recon reports?"
"I did," said Hark. "We were warned of enemy activity. We moved judiciously and took precautions. Despite that, they surprised us. It's called an ambush. It happens in war. It's part of the risk you take in a military action."
"Are you siding with him?" asked Elthan.
"I'm remaining neutral and objective. I'm pointing out that even the best commander must expect attacks and losses. I'm suggesting you return to your vehicle and supervise the resumption of this convoy."
"I don't..."
"No, you don't understand, because you are not a soldier, Intendant. We have a saying on my homeworld. Sometimes you get the carniv, and sometimes the carniv gets you."
Elthan turned disdainfully and stalked away. Down the road, a trio of Pardus tanks had lowered their dozer blades and were ploughing the Chelon carcasses off the thoroughfare. Headlamps gleamed like little full moons in the dusk.
"What's the matter?" Hark asked Gaunt. "You look, I don't know, startled, I suppose."
Gaunt shook his head and didn't reply. In truth, he was startled at the way Hark had come to his defense. Elthan had been talking a lot of crap, but he'd been spot on about Hark's purpose here. It was common knowledge. Hark himself had been brutally matter-of-fact about it from the outset. He was Lugo's punisher, here to oversee the end of Gaunt's command. Gaunt knew little of Hark's background or past career, but the same was clearly not true in reverse. Hark had casually reeled off the most notable actions of the ghosts under Gaunt from memory, and he'd spoken with what seemed genuine admiration.
"Have you made a particular study of my career, Hark?"
Of course. I have been appointed to serve the Tanith First as Commissar. I'd be failing in that duty if I did not thoroughly acquaint myself with its history and operations, wouldn't I?
And what did you learn from that study?
That despite a history of clashes with the upper echelons of command, you have a notable service record. Hagia is your first true failure, but it is a failure of such magnitude that it threatens to eclipse all you have done before.
Really? Do you really believe I deserve sole blame for the disaster in the Doctrinopolis?
Lord General Lugo is a Lord General, Gaunt. That is the most complete answer I can give you.
Gaunt nodded with an unfriendly smile.
There is justice beyond rank, Hark. Slado believed that. Rest his good soul, the Emperor protects. But Makaroth is War Master now.
The candid honesty of the response struck Gaunt. For the first time he felt something other than venom towards Commissar Victor Hark. To be part of the Imperial Guard was to be part of a complex system of obedience, loyalty, and service. More often than not, that system forced men into obligations and decisions they'd otherwise not choose to make. Gaunt had butted up against the system all his career. Was he now seeing that mirrored in another? Or was Hark just dangerously persuasive? The latter notion seemed likely. Charisma was one of the chief tools of a good commissar, and Hark seemed to have it in spades, to say the right thing at the right time for the right effect. Was he just playing with Gaunt?
"I've detailed some platoons to bury the dead here," Hark said. "We can't afford to carry them with us. A small service should do it, consecrated by the Pardus chaplain. The wounded are a bigger problem. We have 9 serious, including Captain Herodas. Medic Kurth tells me at least 2 of them won't live if they don't reach a hospital by tomorrow. The others will perish if we keep them with us."
"Your suggestion?"
"We're less than a day out from the Doctrinopolis. I suggest we sacrifice a truck and send them back to the city with a driver and maybe a few guards."
"That would be my choice, too.
Arrange it, please, Hark. Select a Munitorium driver and 1 ghost trooper, 1 single good man, as armed escort."
Hark nodded. There was a long pause, and Gaunt thought Hark was about to speak again. Instead, he walked away into the gathering gloom. It was approaching midnight when the last elements of the Honor Guard convoy rolled into the deserted village of Mukret. Both moons were up, one small and full, the other a large, perfect geometric semicircle, and dazzling ribbons of stars decorated the dark blue sky. Gaunt looked up at them as he jumped down from his command vehicle. The Sabbat Worlds. The battleground he had come to with Slado all those years before. The starscape of the Crusade. For a moment he felt as if it all depended on this little world, on this little night, on this little continent, on him. They were the Sabbat Worlds because this was Sabbat's world, the saints' place. If ever a soldier had to face his final mission, none could be more worthy. Slado would have approved, Gaunt considered. Slado would have wanted to be here. They weren't storming some fortress world or decimating the legions of the arch-enemy. Such worthy glories and battle honors seemed slight and meaningless compared to this. They were here for the saint. Alpha AR had secured the empty town. The tanks and carriers rolled in, choking the cold night air with their thunderous exhausts and dazzling lamps. The main town road was full of vehicles and disembarking troops. Braziers were lit, and pickets arranged. McCall saluted Gaunt as he approached. "You had some trouble, sir."
"Sometimes the carniv gets you, Sergeant," Gaunt replied.
"Sir?"
"From tomorrow we run a spearhead under your command. Hard armor, fast moving."
"Not my way, sir, but if you insist."
"I do. We were caught napping and paid for it. My mistake."
"No one's mistake, sir."
"Perhaps. But it can only get worse from here. Spearhead from Mukret at dawn. Can you manage that?"
McCall nodded.
"Do you want to choose the formation, or do you trust me to do it?"
The scout sergeant smiled.
"You call the shot, sir. I've always preferred it that way. I'll consult Cleopas and let you know."
They walked through the bustle of dismounting personnel.
"I've met a man here," McCall said, "a sort of vagrant priest. You should talk to him."
"To confess my sins?"
"No, sir. He's, well, I don't know what he is, but I think you'll like him."
"Right," said Gaunt.
He and McCall sidestepped as Tanith troopers backed across their path, carrying ammo boxes and folded mortars for the perimeter defense.
Sorry, sir, said Larkin, struggling with a heavy shell crate.
As you were, Lux, Gaunt smiled.
Tough luck about Milo, said Larkin.
Gaunt felt his blood chill.
For one dreadful moment he wondered if he'd missed Bryn's name on the casualty roll.
Tough luck. Him going back to the city like that. He'll miss the show.
Gaunt nodded warily and called over Sergeant Baffles, Milo's platoon commander.
Where's Trooper Milo?
Heading back to the Doctrinopolis with the wounded.
I thought you knew, sir.
Baffles, chunky and bearded, looked awkwardly up at the Colonel Commissar.
Hark selected him.
Baffles nodded. He said you wanted a good man to ride shotgun for the wounded.
Carry on, Sergeant.
Gaunt walked through the busy activity of the convoy, away down to the river's edge, where the rippling water reflected back the moons and the chirrup of night insects filled every angle of the darkness.
Milo.
Gaunt had always joked about the way the men saw Bryn Milo as his lucky charm. He'd tease them for their superstitious foolishness. But in his heart, silently, he'd always felt that it was actually true. Milo had a charmed life. He had the pure flavor of lost Tanith about him. He was their last and only link to the ghost's past. Gaunt had always kept him close for that reason, though he'd never, ever admitted it. Hark had chosen Milo to be the one to return to the Holy City.
Accident? Coincidence? Design?
Hark had already stated he had studied the Tanith records. He had to know how psychologically important Bryn was to the ghosts.
To Gaunt.
Gaunt had a nasty feeling he'd been deliberately undermined. Worse still, he had a feeling of doom. For the first time, they were going out without Milo. He already knew this mission was going to be his last. Now, with a sense of terrifying premonition, he felt it was going to turn bad. Very bad, indeed. Far away now, chasing back down the Temberong Road towards the Doctrinopolis, the lone troop truck thundered through the night. Milo had ridden in the cab for the first part of the overnight journey, but the obese Munitorium driver had proved to be surly and taciturn, and then had begun to exhibit a chronic flatulence problem that would have been offensive even in an open-topped car. Milo had climbed back to spend the rest of the trip with the wounded men. Commissar Hark had singled him out for this duty. Milo wondered why. There were any number of troopers who could have done the job. Milo wondered if Hark had chosen him because he hadn't been a proper trooper long. Despite his uniform, some of the ghosts still regarded him as the token civilian. He resented that. He was a fething Imperial Guardsman, and he'd take physical issue with anyone who doubted that. Even more, he resented missing out on what he knew would be the last action of the Tanith ghosts under Ibram Gaunt. He doubted there would be much glory in the mission, but still he yearned to be there. He felt cheated. Then, as he watched the moon's light flicker on the river dashing by, he wondered if Gaunt had told Hark to select him. His encounter with Gaunt in the Universitariat still stung. Had Gaunt really wished him away? Most of the wounded were unconscious or asleep. Milo sat beside Captain Herodas in the back of the rocking truck. The captain was pale from blood loss and trauma, and his face was pinched. Milo was afraid Herodas wasn't going to make it back to the Doctrinopolis, despite Medic Kurth's ministrations. He'd lost so much blood.
"Don't you go dying on me, sir," he growled at the supine officer.
"I won't. I swear it,"
Herodas murmured.
"Just a bad wound. They'll fix you up. Feth, you'll get an augmetic knee soon as look at you."
Herodas laughed, but no sound came out of him.
"Sergeant Vahl in my mob, he's got an augmetic shoulder. The latest fething bionics."
"Yeah,"
whispered Herodas. Milo wanted to keep him talking. About anything. Any old nonsense. He was worried what might happen if Herodas fell asleep.
"Oh yes, sir, the latest thing. Claims he can crack null nuts in his armpit now, he does."
Herodas chuckled.
"You're going to miss all the fun coming back with us," he said.
Milo grimaced.
"Not so much fun. The Colonel Commissar's swan song. No great glory in being there for that."
"He's a good man,"
mumbled Herodas, moving his body as much as the pain allowed to resettle more comfortably.
"A fine commander. I didn't know him well, but from what I saw, I'd have been proud to be numbered as one of his."
"He does his job," said Milo.
"And more. Vervenhive. I read the dispatches about that. What an action. What a command. Were you there for that?"
"Hab by Feth and Hab, sir.
Herodas coughed and smiled.
Something of note. Something to be proud of.
That was just the usual. Milo lied, his eyes now hot with angry tears.
Glory like that? You take it with you to the end of your days, trooper.
Herodas fell silent and seemed to be sleeping. Captain. Captain.
What?
Asked Herodas, blinking up. Nothing. I see the lights. I see the Doctrinopolis. We're almost there.
That's good, trooper.
Milo. That's Milo, sir.
That's good, Milo. Tell me what you see.
Milo rose up in the flatbed of the bouncing truck and looked out through the windy dark at the lambent flames burning distantly on the citadel. They made a beacon in the night.
I see the holy city, sir.
Do you?
Yes, I see it. I see the lights.
How I want to be there.
Herodas whispered.
Sir? What did you say, sir?
Milo looked down, out of the wind, holding on tight to the truck's stanchions.
My name is Lucan Herodas. I don't feel like being a sir anymore. Call me by my name.
I will, Lucan.
Herodas nodded slowly.
Tell me what you see now, Milo.
I see the city gates. I see the roofs and towers. I see the temples glowing like starflies in the dark.
Lucan Herodas didn't reply. The truck rolled in under the pilgrim gate. Dawn was just a suggestion at the horizon. 10 minutes later, the truck drew up in the yard of the Western City Infirmary. By then, Herodas was dead. Chapter 8 The Wounded. As I have been called to the holy work, so I will call others to me. Saint Sabbat, Epistles.
A fine, fair, bright morning, Colm, you old dog,
Dawdon announced as he walked into the little side room that had been reserved for the Tanith second in command. Early daylight poured in like milk through the west-facing casement. The air was cool with the promise of a hot day ahead. A smell of antiseptic wafted in from the hospital halls. There came no immediate reply, but then Corbeck was a notoriously heavy sleeper.
Did you sleep well?
Dawdon asked conversationally, moving towards the cabinet beside the gauze-veiled bed. He hoped the sound of his voice would slowly, gently, rouse the colonel so he could check him over. More than one orderly had received a slap in the mouth for waking Corbeck too abruptly. Dawdon picked up a small pottery flask of painkillers.
Colm, how did you sleep? With all the noise, I mean.
The sounds of the relentless evacuation had gone on all night, and even now he could hear the thump of equipment and bustle of bodies in the street outside. Every half hour, the ascending wail of transporter jets roared over the Doctrinopolis as bulk transports lifted away into the sky. The considerable Gothic manse of the Schola Medicae Hagius lay on the west bank of the Holy River, facing the Universitariat, and thus occupied the heart of one of the most populated and active city quarters. A municipal infirmary and teaching hospital attached to the Universitariat, the Schola Medicae was one of the many city institutions sequestered by the Imperial Liberation Force to treat wounded men.
Funny, I don't seem to be sleeping at all well myself,
Dawdon said absently, weighing the pill bottle in his hand.
Too many dreams. I'm dreaming about my son a lot these days. Mikal, you know. He comes to me in my dreams all the time. I haven't worked out what he's trying to tell me, but he's trying to tell me something.
Below the little room's window, an argument broke out. Heated voices rose in the still, clear air. He went to the window, unlatched the casement, and leaned out.
"Keep it down!"
he yelled into the street below.
"This is meant to be a hospital. Have you no compassion?"
The voices dropped away, and he turned back to face the veiled bed.
"This feels light to me,"
he said softly, gesturing with the flask.
"Have you been taking too many? It's no joke, Corbeck. These are powerful drugs. If you're abusing the dose."
His voice trailed off. He stepped towards the bed and pulled back the gauzy drapes. The bed was empty. Rucked. Slept in. But empty.
"What the feth?"
Dawdon murmured. The Basilica of Macarius Hagia was a towering edifice on the east side of the Holy Ditch Chelon Markets. It had four steeples clad in grey-green ashlar, a stone imported from off-world, and which contrasted starkly with the pinks and russets and creams of the local masonry. A massive statue of the Lord Solar in full armour, raising his lightning claws to the sky in a gesture of defiance or vengeance, stood upon a great brick plinth in the entrance arch.
Inside, out of the day's rising heat, it was cold and expansive. Doves and rat-birds fluttered in the open roof spaces and flickered across the staggeringly broad beams of sunlight that stabbed down into the nave. The place was busy, even at this early hour. Blue-robed Ayatani bustled about, preparing for one of the morning rites. Isholi fetched and carried for them, or attended the needs of the many hundreds of worshippers gathering in the grand nave. From the east side, the breeze carried the smells of cooking fish and bread, the smells of the public kitchens adjoining the temple, whose charitable work was to produce alms and free sustenance twice a day for the visiting pilgrims. The smells made Bandawa hungry, as he limped in down the main colonnade amidst the other faithful, his stomach gurgled painfully. He stopped for a moment and leaned hard on his walking stick until the dizzying discomfort passed. He hadn't eaten much since taking his wound, hadn't done much of anything, in fact. The medics had banned him from even getting out of bed, but he knew best how he felt. Strong, surprisingly strong. And lucky. The ritual blade had missed his heart by the most remarkably slim margin. The doctors worried the wound might have left a glancing score across the heart muscle, a weakness that might rupture if he exerted himself too soon. But he could not just lie in bed. This world, Hagia, it was coming to an end. The streets were full of military personnel and civilians trying to pack up and ship out the contents of their lives. There was fear in the air, and a strange sense of unreality. He started to walk again, but had to stop quickly. He was still light-headed, and sometimes the wound ache in his chest came in bitter waves.
"Are you all right, sir?"
asked a passing Isholi, a teenage boy in cream-silk robes. There was concern in the eyes of the shaven-headed youth.
"Can I help you to a seat?"
Perhaps, yes. I may have overdone things."
The student took his arm and guided him across to a nearby bench. Dower lowered himself gratefully onto it.
"You're very pale, sir. Should you even be on your feet?"
"Probably not, thank you.
It'll be fine now I'm sitting."
The student nodded and moved on, though Dower saw him again some minutes later, talking to several Ayatani and pointing anxiously Dower's way. Dower ignored them and sat back to gaze up at the high altar. The shortness of breath was the worst thing. Exertion got him out of breath so quickly, and then he couldn't catch it back because taking deep breaths was agony on his wound. No, that wasn't the worst thing. A knife in the chest wasn't the worst thing. Being injured in battle and missing the last mission of his regiment, even that wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was the thing in his head. And that wouldn't leave him alone. He heard voices exchanging hard words nearby and looked round. So did all the worshippers in earshot. Two Ayatani were arguing with a group of officers from the Ardelian colonials. One of the colonials was repeatedly gesturing to the reliquary. Dower heard one of the priests say,
"But this is our heritage. You will not ransack this holy place."
Dower had heard the same sentiments expressed several times in the last day or so. Despite the abominable evil that moved towards them with the clear intent to engulf the entire world, few native Hagians wanted the evacuation. Many of the Ayatani, in fact, saw the removal of icons and relics for safekeeping tantamount to desecration. But Lord General Lugo's decrees had been strict and inflexible. Dower wondered how long it would be before a Hagian was arrested for obstruction or shot for disobedience. He felt an immeasurable sympathy for the faithful. It was almost as if his wounding had been an epiphany. He'd always been a dutiful man, dutiful to the imperial creed, a servant of the God Emperor, but he'd never thought of himself as especially devout. Until now. Until here on Hagia. Until, it seemed to Bandawa, the very moment an Infadi dagger had punched between his ribs. It was like it had changed him, as if he'd been transformed by sharp steel and his own spilt blood. He heard about men undergoing religious transformations. It scared him. It was in his head, and it wouldn't leave him alone. He felt he needed to do something about it, desperately. Limping his way from the infirmary to the nearest temple was a start, but it didn't seem to achieve much. Dower didn't know what he expected to happen. A sign, perhaps. A message. Such a thing didn't seem very likely. He sighed and sat back with his eyes closed for a moment. He was scheduled to join a troopship with the other walking wounded at 6 that evening. He wasn't looking forward to it. It felt like running away.
When he opened his eyes, he saw a familiar figure amongst the faithful at the foot of the main altar. It was such a surprise, Dawa blinked in confusion. But he was not mistaken. There was Colm Corbeck, his left arm webbed in a sling tight against his bandaged chest, the sleeve of his black fatigue jacket hanging empty, kneeling in prayer. Dawa waited. After a few minutes, Corbeck stood up, turned, and saw Dawa sitting in the pews. A look of puzzlement crossed the grizzled giant's face. He came over at once.
"Didn't expect to see you here, Dawa."
"I didn't expect to see you either, Kano."
Corbeck sat down next to him.
"Shouldn't you be resting in bed?"
Corbeck asked.
"What? What's so funny?"
"I was about to ask you that."
"Yeah, well," Corbeck murmured, "you know me. Can't abide to be lying around idle." "Has there been any word from the honor guard?"
Corbeck shook his head. "Not a thing.
Faith, but I—"
"You what?"
"Nothing."
"Come on, you started to say something.
Something I don't think you'd understand, or—"
"Okay."
They sat in silence for a while.
"What?"
Dawa looked round sharply at Corbeck.
What?
Growled Corbeck.
"You spoke."
"I didn't.
Just then, Colonel.
You said—"
"I didn't say anything, Dawa."
"You said Sabbath Mater. I heard you."
"Wasn't me. I didn't speak."
Dawa scratched his cheek.
"Never mind."
What were those words?"
"Sabbath Mater, or something like that."
"Oh." The silence between them returned. The basilica choir began to sing, the massed voices shimmering the air.
"You hungry, Ban?" "Starving, sir."
"Let's go to the public kitchens and get some breakfast together. I thought the temple kitchens were meant to serve the faithful."
"They are,"
said Corbeck, getting to his feet, an enigmatic half-smile on his lips.
"Come on."
They got bowls of fish broth and hunks of crusty husk-seed bread from the long canopied counters of the kitchens, and went to sit amongst the breakfasting faithful at the communal trestle tables under a wide, flapping awning of pink canvas.
Dawa watched as Corbeck pulled what looked like a couple of pills from his coat pocket and gulped them down with the first sip of broth.
He didn't comment.
"There's something not right in my head, Ban,"
Corbeck began suddenly, through a mouthful of bread.
"In my head, or my gut, or my soul, or whatever.
Somewhere.
It's been there off and on since I was held captive by Peter Sin, rot his bones."
"What sort of thing?"
"The sort of thing a man like me, a man like you too, would be my guess, has no idea what to do with. It's lurked in my dreams, mostly. I've been dreaming about my father, back home on Las Tanith."
"We all have dreams of our old worlds,"
said Dawa cautiously.
"It's the guard curse."
"Sure enough, Ban, I know that.
I've been guard long enough. But not dreams like this. It's like there's a meaning to be had. Like, oh, I don't know."
Corbeck frowned as he struggled to find adequate words.
"Like someone's trying to tell you something,"
Dawa whispered softly.
"Something important. Something that has to be done."
"Sacred Faith,"